This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Time to put on the show.
It is Danny and Gallant. Michael Bumpus sitting in today for Paul Gallant and for Blue 42. We get the privilege of having Jake Heaps join us, and he's going to be coming to us from Orlando, where he's at the Pro Bowl. Blue 42 coming at you now.
Here we go.
This is Coors Light's Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, G, U corner, halfback, flat, on two. Ready, right.
Blue 42 is brought to you by Coors Light. The mountains turn blue at 42 degrees.
Blue 42!
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42! Blue 42!
Excited to have Jake Heaps with us here on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. Jake, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing pretty well. We're sorting through a number of different things, whether or not the Trey Flowers can take the jump that Shaquille Griffin took this year. We also started out by, there was somebody on this radio station who made the observation and looked at what's happened over these past 3 years and asked whether we're getting the most out of the quarterback who's in his prime. I'm interested in your perspective, Jake, because I think there's a lot here about whether the Seahawks are making the most of what they have right now in a franchise quarterback in Russell Wilson.
Well, it is interesting when you put things into perspective, because in 2017 is really when I said that window started of whether you can start questioning that, in that particular question. In 2017, you look at the roster, and Russell had the weapons. He had Doug Baldwin, Tyler Lockett. He had Paul Richardson, who had a great year that year, Jimmy Graham. But the huge underlying issue with that was that he had a horrific offensive line and he had zero running game. And so as a offense, as a team, they were not built to be able to get it done in the way that you're hoping to. And that has to do with the misses that they made in terms of their decisions in free agency and through the draft. And I think that that's really ultimately what it comes down to, guys, is that I think that they've made good decisions along the way in terms of 2018 to say, you know what, we're going to cut ties with a lot of the former all-pro players that we had. That's going to be tough, but we need to in terms of cap space health and also for to rebuild that culture and to make Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner uplifted and be the focal points and the leaders of the team. I agree with all those decisions, but you're in this window right now where Russell Wilson is without a doubt in his prime. And are you doing the most to surround himself with the best talent, the best protection, and capitalize on these crucial years that you have to go get a Super Bowl? And I think that this particular offseason in 2020, look, we always say every offseason is huge, but I really firmly believe that you're at a crossroads here, and the decisions that this front office makes, that Pete Carroll, John Snyder, and this crew makes to surround Russell Wilson with talent or not, and let him, you know, do the most with less, I think is going to be a very interesting move on their part.
So much to dig into there. It is a great opportunity to look at what's happening. A little bit more quarterback news. Who's had the better career, Eli Manning or Phillip Rivers?
Oh, man, that is really tough, because the thing is I really think ultimately it comes down to Super Bowls. And so for that reason, Eli Manning to me has had the overall better career from that standpoint. I mean, it's hard to knock anybody who has won two Super Bowls and has been able to take down the New England Patriots. I think that you know, for a lot of people, makes a lot of people happy. But Phillip Rivers has had an unbelievable career. You know, you talk about a guy who has done everything the right way and has really played the position at a very high level for a long time. It's Phillip Rivers. And, you know, statistically, I think that Phillip is better than Eli. But you can't knock Eli with the two Super Bowl rings. So very tough. If I were to take, I say Eli had the better career. But if you ask me which one would I rather take, I'd rather take Phillip Rivers.
What do you think, Bump? How do you look at those two quarterbacks in their careers?
Ah, man, Eli's is so underwhelming. You know,
I didn't think he was a Hall of Famer until I looked at his numbers. And then I'm like, okay, this guy deserves to be in. He's at two Super Bowls, two Super Bowl MVPs, has two great plays. But you look at Phillip Rivers, man, that's a guy that I would go into battle with. That's a guy who I feel like will compete until he dies. Whereas Eli Manning, I feel like, man, once the game's over, he's just going to roll over and give up. So I'm with Jake, man. I'll take Phillip Rivers all day, every day.
Yeah, man. It's such a – it's fascinating. And it also calls into question kind of the idea of how you view the franchise around them. Because Eli Manning,
right.
while the Giants have had – they've had a rougher turn recently, the way they burned through coaches and turned over the front office. But for the breadth of their careers, Eli Manning's had the better franchise to play for, I would say.
He has, and that's the interesting part is, really, Phillip has done more with less, in my opinion, over the course of his career. But you look at the heavy dysfunction that Eli faced, you know, really in the last 5-6 years of his career, and you just wonder what his career could have been had it been more stable, had the Giants organization not fell completely apart around him. To me, that's one of the big questions that I would have about Eli Manning. But I think the fact that you're looking at a guy who, you know, threw a great amount of touchdowns, but also threw a ton of interceptions, I think, you know, a lot of those interceptions being, you know, head-scratching interceptions, I think that's the reason why, Buff, you're feeling that way. You know, as we sit here today, and Phillip Rivers, you know, although, you know, this the last two seasons, I would say, his fourth quarter comebacks have really kind of been a black mark for him. Phillip Rivers has otherwise had a pretty outstanding career, just has not been able to get it done in the postseason.
Question three.
All right, Jake. The 49ers made it to the Super Bowl while attempting 8 passes. Is that a template Seattle wants to follow? How realistic is that?
I don't even think the 49ers could believe what happened. I mean, to only throw 8 passes in an NFC championship game, I mean, get out of here, guys. That doesn't happen. But I think it just goes to show the uniqueness of the 49ers, the uniqueness of their running game, their scheme. And, yeah, they've got incredible talent up front. They're tight end with their fullback. But ultimately, it comes down to how can we run the football in so many unique and different ways that consistently gets the opposing defense in a bind, in tough places. And Kyle Shanahan does a great job with that. I mean, he is the number one offensive play caller in terms of motions and shifts before the play call. So he uses it over, I think it's 50% of the time, close to 60%, is there always a motion, always a shift. It's changing the eyes, and there's misdirection on every single run that really causes for these wide-open running lanes. So you have, you know, really 3 running backs at any time for the San Francisco 49ers. Although they're talented in their own right, they're not superstars. But they at any point, either one of those guys can have a big game, and it really comes down to the scheme. So I think you got to tip of the cap that way. And I do think that for the Seahawks, they have evolved. They've evolved a little bit, and they've been willing to say, "Hey, we're gonna put it in Russell's hands just a little bit more, not to the amount that everybody would like it to be." But I think that they're evolving in that direction, and it's more. It's always going to be about establishing the run with Pete Carroll, but how do you go about that? And I think for them, you know, and for many other teams across the NFL, they're going to be looking at Kyle Shanahan and seeing how in the heck did he do what he did this year. And I hope that would bring a little more diversity to the Seahawks running game, allowing them to be more explosive, allowing them to be a more diverse offense.
Jake, do you think that the Niners went into that NFC Championship game thinking we're just going to run the heck out of the ball, or do you think they found success and said, hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it?
I think it's more of the second one, Michael. I really think that they came into the game wanting to run the football and be effective that way, because that's how they won last time too. When they played the Green Bay Packers, they ran the ball all over them and blew them out. And so I think that they were going to test the waters and see how it went and see if the Green Bay Packers and Mike Pettine could stop them. And they couldn't. And if you notice on the first, you know, really it was the first two drives of the game. The second drive of the game, it was actually very balanced. Jimmy Garoppolo had a couple passes, a couple runs mixed in. It was a very clean, nice drive, both in the pass and the run game. But overall, once you got through that initial wave of the first two, three series, Kyle Shanahan and the 49ers really knew that they were going to be able to get after him in the run game. And it really didn't make any sense at that point to try and pass the football and limit possession or give Aaron Rodgers more possessions with the football. So I think that it just went up. As the game went on, they realized, hey, Jimmy, you rest your arm, man, because we got this thing on the ground.
That is Blue 42. It's brought to us thanks to Toyota, Puyallup Toyota. Really grateful for them and having Jake Heaps with us here. Jake, you're down at the Pro Bowl. Well, what's it like down there?
Yeah, it's interesting, Danny. I'll say that, you know, from a Pro Bowl standpoint, because you're used to, or at least I am, NFL practices and with the Seahawks in particular, flying around and having fun and guys very intense. The Pro Bowl is different in that regard. It's not nearly as intense. It's not nearly as competitive, all that. But all these guys are finishing their year. They're reflective. They're appreciative. They're excited to be down here with their families. It's a very cool experience from that standpoint. And I'll tell you this. This is a really cool nugget that I was able to gather and continue to gather while I'm here. Over today or yesterday was really the first day that they practiced. Today they practice again. But the sentiment that I've had, not just talking to, you know, Russell and Shaquille, but other players on the roster for this Pro Bowl in the NFC, is they are blown away by Pete Carroll. They're blown away by the Seahawks coaching staff. And I think it's really cool to sit there and look at and be reflective. There's been a lot of conversation about Pete Carroll and what should we do with him, and you know, what's the long term here. Pete Carroll is an unbelievable coach in terms of building culture, in terms of getting guys to buy in, and don't underestimate this opportunity for the Seahawks coaching staff to be able to coach in this Pro Bowl with this NFC group, because I guarantee you there's almost every single one of these guys on this roster that are looking at it going, I want to go to Seattle. I want to play for this guy. I can't believe that meetings and practice and his approach are like this every single day. And so that's been a really cool thing to kind of talk to, not Seahawk guys, because they're used to it, but other guys on other teams. And I won't get into specific names, but just those guys are blown away. I talked to about seven guys, different guys, and they just blown away by Pete Carroll and the staff.
Is Russell really wearing a man bun?
not at all times. He did at one point earlier this week, but no, it is not a consistent hair choice. So don't, if you're concerned about that, Danny,
I'm very concerned.
Don't let it concern you, Danny. It's okay. Just every now and then, feel like shaking it up. You just throw it in the man bun for the time being. His hair is abnormally very long right now. So, one of the big off-season questions, I guess, that we'll have moving forward is what does he do with his hair? That always seems to be some topic of conversation as to the off-season, as to what is Russell doing these days.
Jay, yeah. Jay, here's a real question for you. What is it worth going to Orlando to go to Disney World? And should I spend $10,000 to get my whole family down there?
Whew, bump. Here's my initial answer. Yes, absolutely yes. Now, here's the other part, though, is it depends on the age of your kids. I know you got young kids, so Disney World is absolutely going to be, you know, the deal. And you've got not just the main park, but you got like four other parks in Disneyland that you can go to. So I think that's a no-brainer. But if you love roller coasters like I do, the park that you want to go to is Universal Studios.
Okay.
That is just an absolute blast. You got so many fun rides. So I was actually, the funny thing you asked that, Bump, because I was texting my wife yesterday saying, man, I want to bring our family down to Orlando, but we got to wait probably like 10 years so that our kids are old enough that they can enjoy the rides and they're not holding us back. But yes, I would absolutely say, you know, Orlando, Disney World, it's a really fun experience. And these guys are having a blast, and bringing their families along has been really cool for them.
All right, got to do it.
Jake, we really are grateful for you spending some time with us this morning. We look forward to catching up with you soon.
Absolutely. All right, talk soon, guys.
That is Jake Heaps for Blue 42. He joined us courtesy of the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. That question about Russell and the run game, I think it's interesting when he brought up 2017 and he pointed out that they did have an offense that was kind of built to accentuate some of Russell's strengths. And it is true. You had Doug Baldwin, Jimmy Graham was still there, and you had a fairly potent passing game. The one thing that happened that year, and I think that this is probably something worth talking about going forward, was their run game was awful. And the spot where it was the worst, and where I actually think the run game is the most important, is the closer they got to the goal line. I think that year they had something like 15 carries inside the 10-yard line for a net gain of 0 yards. And the rushing touchdown that was scored by a running back, I believe, was J.D. McKissick, and was from outside. They did not have one red zone rushing touchdown by a running back. The only red zone rushing touchdowns came from Russell Wilson. And that pointed to the huge problem. And I think that underscored, in some ways, what we saw in the playoffs was that the offense can't be all Russell. When they get to a point where they can't run the ball and it's all on Russell, they have a real problem, because it's too much and they're not built to play that way.
Yeah, Russell is no Lamar Jackson, and that offense doesn't look like the Baltimore Ravens. So in 2017, Russell Wilson was the offense. He led the team in rushing. He accounted for almost every single touchdown except for one, I believe. So, no, that's not the recipe for success for this football team. And you're right, I think that's when the change started to go. You got rid of Thomas Rawls, you bring some guys in on the offensive line, and you establish a run game. So I think this team is moving in sections, right? Establish the run game, boom, check, got it. Let Russell take over the game earlier in the season or earlier in the game, boom, check it. So I think the next movement or the next step in this offense is just to let Russell run the show while not abandoning the run game. What does that look like? I don't know. You know, I think it might be just spreading the ball out a little bit, throwing on first downs. I don't know what that is. I think just allowing Russell Wilson to make more decisions in the play calling, maybe checking out of things, RPOs. I think that may be the next step. We'll see what they think.
Were you encouraged by the offense overall this season?
Yeah, I was, for the most part. Not in the playoffs, obviously, when you have Lynch in there, you got Travis mm-hmm. Homer. They weren't able to run the football, but they did some good things. You know, I was encouraged because of the emergence of DK Metcalf. I was encouraged because of Tyler Lockett. I was encouraged because Carson went for 1,000 yards again. Russell Wilson took care of the football. Now, they got it done. I'd like to see some other things. I'd like to see some quick games. There's hardly any times where Russell just catches the ball in shotgun and throws a quick slant. A lot of things go off of the play action. So I was encouraged because of the play of some guys, of DK, Tyler, and Carson. Now, I want to see some change in the offense. More quick game. I think they can add quick game to this offense. I think they'll be good to go. But I feel like they're moving in the right direction.
That idea of the quick game and kind of a system, it kind of ties into another thought that I've had. As people have talked about Pete Carroll's offense and sort of, for lack of a better term, kind of modernizing it, the one thing that I think people underestimate is that there's a lot of coaches who would have tried to put Russell in a box. I don't know if Mike Holmgren would have let Russell Wilson play in the way that he plays under Pete Carroll. And what I say by that is that there's a lot of coaches, and especially coaches 10, 15, and 20 years ago, who were like, you're going to run my system. Your job is to run my system. Your job is to make reads. It's honestly how Mike Leach still runs his offense, which is my offense works, and what I need to do is train you to know how to go through your progressions to get to the right spot. Because if you execute this offense like it's drawn up, it's going to work. Russell in Seattle's offense, it's not that he always goes off script, but he goes off script as often, maybe more often than any other quarterback, and the result can be big plays. And other coaches, I think, would freak out about that and would say and would fixate on the times that he takes a 10-yard sack or the times that it's not there. He gets sacked a fair amount. And some of the reason is because he's looking for big plays. Pete Carroll, people should recognize that some of what allows Russell Wilson and accentuates his strengths is the fact that Pete specifically says we want to be the best scrambling team in the NFL. Not every coach, and I don't even think most NFL coaches would take that approach.
Hey, you know why he says that? Because that's what Russell was good at. I think that's what great coaches do. You have a system, yes. You have your philosophy. You've been brought up a certain way. This is what you want to do. You draft a quarterback who you think can fit your system. Now, once you have that quarterback, you see he's good at this. He's good at that. You add that into your system. I feel like sometimes coaches get so fixated on making the quarterback run their system. Make him this way. Make him that way. Take what he does well and let him use it. But still run your offense. I think Jim Harbaugh is a great example of that. He knew what he had in Lamar Jackson. Last year, he tried to make him a pocket passer. Didn't work for him. This year, he said, look, I got a guy who can run. I got a guy who can throw. I'm going to put some running backs in the backfield with him and let him be himself. At some point, coaches have to let players do what they do best within their system.
Yeah, and it's the interesting contrast is that people – and I've heard this characterization. What was it, Jeff Schwartz, when he said, well, Pete's like 70. He's not changing now. There's a growing sense that Pete's a stick in the mud and that he wants to play defense. He doesn't want to go for it on fourth down. He wants to run the ball. That he is, despite all of the upbeat, positive, bringing basketball hoops in to work at the Pro Bowl, he's a guy that's kind of old-fashioned in the way he sees the game. The one place that that's not true and that everybody should consider before they sort of write it off and say, like, oh, he's just he won't learn new tricks is that, yeah, Pete probably – is one of the least controlling coaches when it comes to letting his quarterback run around and play sandlot football. And that's produced huge results for Seattle.
If Pete doesn't let Russell run around and play backyard football, the Hawks don't win 11 games. They don't have a chance to get the number one seed or the number two seed. They don't have a chance to go to the NFC Conference Championship game if Pete Carroll doesn't allow Russell to do those things. So I think Pete Carroll is a great example of letting your players be players. I heard John Madden say this in a clip years ago when he was a coach with the Raiders. He says, I don't want robots out there. I want football players. I want a Jadeveon Clowney to be long and get after the quarterback. I want Russell Wilson to scramble. You know, I want Tyler Lockett to go across the middle because those are all the things that they are good at. Good coaches adjust to their personnel within their system.
Our playoff coverage here, 710 ESPN Seattle, is brought to you by Washington Farm Bureau's Healthcare. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at one reason that we maybe should be worried about holding up the San Francisco 49ers as the model for Seattle to emulate. That's ahead. Danny and Gallant, Michael Bumpus in for Paul Gallant today.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
It is Danny and Gallant. Sans Paul Gallant today, who is on his way to Miami. We've got Michael Bumpus in instead. Bumps, it's been pretty fun for me so far. Are you enjoying it?
Loving it.
Got Maura taking care of things. A one-woman production show in the booth. And there's been a lot of conversation about the fact that San Francisco got this far. Run first. I'm not sure if run first is the right way to characterize it because they're a balanced offense. But they reached the NFC Championship game. They won the NFC Championship game while attempting just 8 passes. It was the most groundbound performance you've seen. And that question of if the conclusion was that Seattle needed to throw more coming out of their loss to Green Bay, well, this pointed to the possibility, no, you can just run more. Here's my question. Can you win that way without a dominant defense? Is a dominating defense, if you're going to have a ground-oriented offense, do you need it paired with the dominant defense?
I think you do. And I think you do because if you're going to run the football a bunch of times, you have to be able – you can't get down. You have to be able to stop the opposition because running the football means you got to put together long drives. Unless you're busting off 30, 40-yard runs, which isn't typical, those runs will happen. But if you're going to run the ball like that, you need to have a defense that's going to stop an offense so you don't get down. If you get down 2 or 3 scores running the football, you're in trouble. Look at the Titans. Strong run game, got down 2 or 3 scores, the game is pretty much over.
That question, and that's probably the part that I'm still, I don't want to say struggling with, but wrestling with, is what's the best approach? If Seattle's defense gets better, this is kind of irrelevant because I don't think the defense needs to get much better, but it needs to be better than it was. And I think Seattle's perfectly capable of taking the next step. I also don't want to jump to too many conclusions based on the end of a season in which they're missing. I mean, they lost their top three running backs in the span of 2 weeks, and entering the playoffs, basically the final four games they played, they did not have access to the top three runners that they would have projected. I don't want to jump to conclusions and say, well, you see, the running game just can't do it, because they didn't have their running game that was there. Yet, I also look at it and say, man, the number of points that they give up and the holes that they put themselves in, it's hard to think that they're going to be able to take that next step next season, that they're going to be able to catch the 49ers if they don't tweak something about their approach.
It's all about that defensive line. If you look at the Niners' secondary, it's a good secondary. You got Richard Sherman back there. They're not superstars. You know, Richard Sherman's a Pro Bowler. He's the exception to the rule. But they look good because that defensive line is ferocious, because they get to the quarterback, because they cause sacks, because they cause havoc. That's what it's all about. That D-line makes everybody else look good. I think that if the Hawks can hold down Jadeveon Clowney, add a few pieces here and there, get some more sack totals, get some more QB pressures, that will make everybody else look good. That will make Trey look better than he looks. That'll make Shaquille look even better. That'll make McDougal look better. That'll make our linebackers look better. So it's all about that D-line, man. 49ers have a great D-line. Everybody looks pretty.
Yeah, and you look at where they got that D-line. Nick Bosa was what, the number two overall pick?
Yep.
Solomon Thomas, I think, is the number three overall pick, and he's been a little bit of a disappointment. Eric Armstead, who's going to be a big-name free agent, he was a first-round pick. DeForest Buckner, he was a top-10 pick, I believe.
Yep.
They got that defensive line because they fell off a cliff, and Seattle hasn't done that, and that's to their credit. They didn't go through a period. I mean, the 49ers burned through coaches. They went John Harbaugh, 1 year of Jim Tom Sula, 2 years of Chip Kelly, and then brought in Kyle Shanahan, and he had two losing seasons before they finally broke through this year. The result of that is all of that high-end draft capital. Now you look at Seattle, you've got Jadeveon Clowney, who I think is a priority for them to re-sign. I think that you want to bring Jaron Reed back. It's a question of economics. And then how do you get better at those other spots when you don't have the top 10 picks that San Francisco is able to work with?
Yeah, and it's tough. You know, that's how the 49ers got good. They've sucked for a while, you know, so you get all those picks. And the Seattle Seahawks just aren't that. And I don't see them being that anytime in the near future. So what do? You got to hit free agency. But free agency is expensive, man. Everybody wants to get paid, and especially at that D-line spot, because they're the quarterbacks of the defense. They get the most money because it's a quarterback league. You got to get after those quarterbacks. So we're going to see what John Schneider and Pete Carroll can do. You know, they're always working. They're always looking for the next guy to bring in. They're always looking to compete. How are they going to maneuver this? Because guys are going to want to get paid.
Yeah, it was interesting. When I was covering the Sonics, and I covered them through kind of their mediocre years before the sale, where they really did go into an earnest rebuilding process, they weren't a bad franchise. They were a mediocre franchise. And they had 1 year in there where they won 52 games and won a first-round playoff series. But at that time, there was kind of this question. The question about the Sonics was, okay, you're high-centered in the middle. It's the worst spot to be in the NBA. You're too good to get the picks that you need to get a superstar. You're too good to really tank, but you're not bad enough to think that, okay, we need to pull the plug and start all over. They had Gary Payton, and then they had Ray Allen. They're kind of in this, they're good. And Seattle's ahead of that right now because they do have the superstar quarterback. But in some ways, they are. And you're seeing in San Francisco, it's like, well, how did they get those sort of players? You exactly said it. They stunk for a period of time. And I remember one of the GMs saying to me of like, there's always a risk when you bottom out, because when you go and start getting all of those picks, you let the culture of your franchise, of your team, take a huge dip, and there's no guarantee it's going to come back out. And they pointed at the time to the post-Jordan Bulls, that they got all these picks, Tyson Chandler and Eddie Griffin and Jamal Crawford, like all these high-end picks, and they weren't ever able to win with them. And part of that was because the culture took a hit. Guys got used to losing and those sort of things. Franchise building is such a fascinating thing, and the Seahawks in some ways are trying to do what I would argue only one other team has really done over the past 20 years, really in the salary cap era, which is stay good. They're trying to stay good through the entirety of a quarterback's career. It's really, really hard to do. And that question of how you do it next, the idea that maybe you end up becoming a more offensive oriented team, I think is a very big possibility, because if you listed their best players right now or their most promising young players, their best players are Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner. I think those two guys are on the list. Jadeveon Clowney's probably on there, a talent. Tyler Lockett. But you look at their best promising young players, Chris Carson, DK Metcalf, Will Disley. It's a lot of offensive players. I'm interested to see the shape that this team takes.
Yeah, I at this point, it's all about surrounding Russell with exactly what he needs for this team to be successful. And I think the Chiefs are a prime example. You don't have to have the greatest defense in the world to be successful. If you can outscore guys, you're good to go. You can put up 45 points a game. You should be in the mix. So it's all about the approach that they're going to take. With the history of Pete Carroll and this organization, I doubt they just neglect that defense, though. You know, they take pride in that defense. But the older Russell Wilson gets, the more expensive he gets, the harder it is to build around him. So there's going to have to be some willing and dealing going on here to try to figure out, okay, can we develop these young guys? I think at this point, they got to put young guys on the field so they don't have to bring in veterans to replace them, because veterans are expensive. You look at everybody that's on the free agent market right now who's third or fourth year, they're going to want some money. Example, Jaron Reed. So it's all about getting these young guys ready at this point. You hear Pete Carroll talk about the young guys, like Cody Barton, wish I would have played him earlier. Ugo Amadi, wish I would have played him earlier. You still got a Marquise Blair. Who knows what LJ Culler is going to form out to be. So they have guys in place to at least do the experiment of playing young guys to see if they can go that route. It's all about building with the young guys. You cannot bring a bunch of veterans in because your salary cap, that cap's going to be gone within minutes.
I agree with you. And the best example of that is going to be what we see happen in Green Bay. Green Bay was extremely aggressive in free agency last year, which is completely uncharacteristic of that organization. They've got a new general manager there. They went out and they signed Za'Darius Smith. They went out and they signed Preston Smith. Those are probably two of certainly the top 10, and maybe some people would argue the top five sort of pass rush presences, defensive line components, or outside edge rushers that were available. They signed those guys and they did make an improvement, but we saw how far they have to go. And going into this offseason, I don't think Green Bay is more encouraged about their future than Seattle is. They certainly don't have reason to be. Their quarterback's older. His play's dropped off. And, well, we saw the gap between them and the San Francisco 49ers in two games, and the Seahawks can at least look at it and say, hey, you know, we stood toe-to-toe with the best team in this conference. As disappointing as it is, we can hope that if we come back healthy, that we're absolutely the measure of them, because San Francisco's, they're through with the point that they're going to start adding things. They're going to be at the spot. Eric Armstead's a free agent. Be very interesting to see if they can afford to keep him with all of the talent they have. They're at the point where they need to worry about keeping everybody. They're not going to be, certainly not this year. They're not going to be drafted in the top 10. So we don't have to worry about a Nick Bosa being added to that defensive line rotation.
Yeah, that's the gift of the curse of being good, man. You get good, and then is what do we do now? You get good, guys start to ball out, guys get exposure, and then they leave and you got to try to replace them. So I think the 49ers are going to hold on. And then going back to the comparison of the Seahawks and Green Bay versus the 49ers, the Seahawks were super competitive against the 49ers, and they were banged up. You got your fourth-string running back. You got your third or fourth-string tight end. You got shuffling going on the offensive line. So they have to be encouraged. You know, hindsight is always 20/20, and the shoulda, coulda, woulda. I hate doing that, but it is what it is. We didn't see the best Seahawk team on that football field, and they still had a chance to win and be successful. So they have to be encouraged at VMAC for sure.
It's Danny and Gallant. Michael Bumpus is in today, and coming up next, I've got a present for him. It's a gift that I'm going to give to Michael Bumpus. I'm going to spotlight a historic achievement by one of my least favorite athletes. I think everybody's going to enjoy it next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
It's not quite the perfect anniversary bump. The game actually happened on January, let's see, it was yesterday, so January 22nd. 2016. Yesterday was the 14th anniversary of the game in which Kobe Bryant, one of your favorites, one of my most disliked athletes, scored 81 points against the Toronto Raptors. It's the second most points that have been scored in an NBA history. And my gift to you today in reward for you getting up early and coming in and sitting in for Paul Gallant is that we will acknowledge the greatness of one Kobe Bean Bryant for the next few minutes.
Love it.
He was incredible. He scored 81 points. Here are some different things that I think are pretty remarkable. He did that in spite of not playing all of the second quarter. He played 42 minutes in the game, so that means he sat for 6 minutes. It's conceivable that had he not sat those 6 minutes, he might have got to Wilt's 100.
He would have dropped a hundo for sure. Hundo, easy hundo. That's Kobe, baby. Kobe. I appreciate you, Danny. I know how you feel about Kobe. You know how I feel about Kobe. So the fact that you took some time to acknowledge the greatness that is Kobe Bean Bryant really warms my heart.
Well, it's not only that. Do you remember where you were when you found out about it?
Yes, I was home from college. I was in Northridge at one of my friend's house. We were sitting there playing a game where you throw a ball into a cup and you drink a substance if you make it.
And, beer pong.
Yes, beer pong.
And cracked. I got so excited.
We were going crazy. Loved it.
It was pretty remarkable. That was the lead up to, I believe, the Seahawks' first Super Bowl appearance. I think that was after the 2005 season. So they're in the way there. Jalen Rose, who I think Jalen Rose is becoming fast my favorite talking figure. My TV shouters. I have my whole little pantheon of Shannon Sharp and Skip Bayless and Colin Cowherd. I think Jalen Rose is my favorite on these. He was on the Raptors. And this is not from anything recently. This is from something he did a while ago called Storytime. But he explained and talked at length about being on the other side of that 81-point performance. Here's his introduction to that.
So before you know it, Kobe's putting up pretty good numbers, but he's not really going off. I think he probably had 20-something in the first half. And then I want to say he erupted for like 40 or something in the third quarter.
How does that happen?
He was dominant over us. You know, when you growing up and then the rim in the backyard is 8 foot tall and there's one guy that can really probably dunk on the 10-foot hoop, but he's playing on the 8-foot hoop. That's how he was dominant, putting a smack down on us. He really did.
Is he talking to you?
He didn't say a word.
Can you believe that? He didn't say anything? Like, how intimidating would that be if a guy is out there, he scored 26 in the first half, he scored 27 in the third quarter, he scored 28 in the fourth quarter, and it's a game where they need it. This wasn't like that the regular season finale for his career when it was basically a layup line. Mm-hmm. They were down 18 early in the third quarter, and they won by 18. Like, he basically single-handed routed the Toronto Raptors.
He took that game over. You know when Kobe gets that look in his eye and he starts grinding his teeth or he's biting his jersey, there's always a Kobe look to where you're like, oh, man, it's about to go down. And the fact that he said nothing, man, that's a cold killer right there, man. You don't say nothing. If I'm dropping 81, Danny, you're going to hear me. I promise you that.
Now, here's the thing. And the next question for Jalen Rose is, well, how many of those were his responsibility?
I just remember realizing at one point in the game, this may be something historic happening right now.
Were you checking him?
Oh, I did guard him. I got a healthy 19.
Like getting served up. And then he explains how Rose subsequently explains how he decided that they at least needed to make Kobe work on the other end. So Jalen Rose takes it down to the other end and tries to post him up. And his coach, Sam Mitchell, goes nuts, yanks him out of the game. And he asks, like, why didn't you double team him? And Jalen Rose goes, that's a good question. Because basically, sometimes your coach wants you to suffer. Like, he feels you're not listening. You're not doing all the things. So he just leaves you out there to suffer to prove a point.
Yeah, go sit on that island. Good luck there, buddy. And I think that was towards the end of Jalen Rose's career too, right? He had to be like mid-30s or something during that time. So he wasn't in his prime. I could imagine, I'm 34 now and I wake up in the morning and I can't move the way I want to. I can imagine trying to guard Kobe Bryant and your body not responding the way you want to. You realize something historic is going down. It's just a nightmare.
And there's also a nod to greatness. Here's how Jalen Rose put it in perspective.
When you're going against a guy like that, there are going to be historic nights. And it's not like Luke Walton scored 20 on me. Like, if that would have happened, I would have buried my hand in the sand.
That was what saved it all for me. What's the most amazing, and this is a question for people out there, what's the most amazing thing that you've seen an athlete do? Because that 81-point performance is up there. That was, I watched a replay of, they have all of his field goals. I think he was 26 of 46, something like that. They have all of his field goals condensed to a minute. You can get that on YouTube. It's unbelievable. I saw a game where Kobe hit 10 threes. That was against the Sonics. That was pretty remarkable. And I remember afterwards, Desmond Mason, who was on the team and was their best defender at the time, saying, I don't want to talk about no freaky 10 three-pointers. Like, he didn't want to discuss it. Honestly, Russell Wilson, in a couple of the games he's had, the comeback against Atlanta that they didn't end up winning is pretty close to that kind of performance where I'm like, I can't believe I just was able to see. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, I would have to say 2008 U.S. Open Tiger Woods. Knowing he was injured, the putts he was hitting, the drives. I mean, it was beautiful. I was in training camp at the time with the Seattle Seahawks, and there's 30 grown men packed in one hotel room just going nuts watching this guy dominate a golf course. So I would have to put the 2008 U.S. Open up there as well.
253 texts in. Clay Thompson when he scored 37 points in a quarter.
Yeah.
Yes, that was unbelievable. Beastquake. Beastquake was a moment. Beastquake was a moment as opposed to a game. Beastquake is the single best moment I've ever been able to see. There's nothing, not being in Candlestick Park for the earthquake during the 1989 World Series, which I'll never forget. But Beastquake was the single most memorable thing I've ever seen and witnessed at a sporting event. But that wasn't... There's something different when it's a series of plays, because it's not like, oh, everything aligned on this one play. It's like, oh, this guy's having a game. Like this guy, oh my gosh, get him the ball. He cannot miss. There's something different. Or like Tiger Woods, where it's a series of shots where you continuously kind of keep upping the level. You're like, it can't keep going like this. And then it does keep going like that.
Yeah, it's like when you just see somebody just get into the zone. I think that's what's great about athletics. You see and feel when someone's in the zone, and it's like, everything's happening perfectly for them. They can do no wrong. So, yeah, I'm with you. When an athlete continuously gets better and better throughout a game, throughout a series or whatnot, it's definitely fun to watch.
There's a lot of good suggestions that have been texted in here. Most amazing thing that you've ever seen, most best game, best moment, text them in, 710-710. It is Danny and Gallant right now. Michael Bumpus in with us this morning. We'll get some of your best moments next. We'll also take a look at the Seahawks and whether or not they need to do more to make the most of having a franchise quarterback like Russell Wilson.